and welcome to this episode of The Op-Ed Page with me, Elisa Kammerhorn Page. This is my regular look at everything that's catching my eye, piquing my interest, and causing me to dig a little deeper across the worlds of politics, pop culture, activism, technology, and more. And when I'm lucky, I get to talk to amazing leaders, authors, and overall geniuses and share that conversation with you. So sit back, relax, or grab your walking shoes and get moving. Whatever it is you do when you're listening to podcasts, let's do it. And as always, if you like what you hear, please share and subscribe, and even rate and review on your favorite listening platform. You know how much we podcasters love that. But let's dig in. In this week's episode, I'm excited to welcome a new friend and colleague, June Johnson, who is the founder of Collective High and the Weed Doula. And we will talk a little bit about what she means by that, what kind of services she offers, and what has changed and really blown up about the cannabis, both as an industry and as a consumable. She's got all the answers. Well, as I said, I'm so excited today to welcome June Johnson to the podcast. June is the founder of a company called Collective High, and we're going to talk all about that. Don't worry. But June, thank you, first of all, so much for joining me here today. I'm really so looking forward to speaking with you.
Oh my gosh. Thank you so much for having me. I have been so excited about this all day long.
Yeah, me too. So
I really appreciate this space.
Awesome.
I'm looking forward to having a conversation with you.
So anyone who listens to my interviews knows that I almost always start out by asking about your origin story. And part of this for me came out of early in the pandemic. My significant other and I watched all 23 at the time Marvel Cinematic Universe movies that I mostly had not seen, watched them all in a row, like in the first 30 days. And I really love the concept of origin story because it's more than saying, oh, you know, where'd you grow up or where'd you come from? But it's about how you grew up and where you grew up and what kind of grown-up did you imagine being when you were growing up?
I love that. And I also did the same thing during the pandemic. I hadn't watched any of the Marvel movies and I was like, okay, how many are there? And
so it should take us a while.
Kind of sped it up faster than I thought it was going to.
Yep. But,
I love that ideation around what is your story. I grew up around really great minds, really inquisitive minds and people who wanted to do right by the Black community. And I came from, on my mom's side, a family of lawyers and therapists. And whereas I appreciate it now, at the time, it was a little rough. Starting about when I was like 12 years old, we always would have like really deep family discussions around dinner and events and stuff like that. And you're expected to, you know, bring forth contribution to the conversation that was of interest, not kid-like. And I'll never forget, I brought out a fact. I was really proud of myself. I was 12 and my cousin, who was the former mayor of Atlanta, he was like, that is so beautiful. And I'm so glad you contributed in that way. We won't do it this time, but next time you will need to name a source if you're going to say a fact. And I was like, oh, okay. And he's like, three actually, but we'll go easy on you since you're young. But like, this was like so serious.
And he was preparing you for the nerd internet, like site.
Absolutely. And like, it has stuck with me in such a transformative way.
Yeah.
So that's the kind of ilk I come from. You know, sometimes it gets into like a little competitive stride, but mostly it's just being educated, sharing that education and contributing in a way that moves the needle for those around you. And so that sticks with me. And so growing up, my dad was a Marine, so we hopped here and there everywhere. And I feel like that also so contributes to my origin story because I was a shy child. And so having to disrupt so many times and just, here we go again. My name is Aisha, which is my first name. I go by June now, but, it really developed me into being able to be talkative with new people, explore, feel fine and independent on my own. And so I think between all of that, it really just helped me be the person who I am today, which is more or less who I figured I would be, which is, you know, an outspoken person who has an exciting job and really cares about people and tries to bring all of these really seemingly probably unrelated things into the mix, into one career in a way.
I'm so excited to hear that part of your story, because the next question I wanted to ask you about was not based on knowing that your dad was a Marine and that you moved a lot. So one of my favorite words is peripatetic. It's a really obscure kind of, it's in a chorus line. That's where I first heard it. It's in that big song One from A Chorus Line. And I always just thought it rolled off the tongue so nicely, peripatetic. And it means traveling from place to place, being a bit nomadic. Mm-hmm. And I wrote down, I apply this to myself professionally, not necessarily geographically. And I was wondering if that word resonated with you, because it seems to me that you have had and do have a lot of irons in various fires, and that's what you've been doing, and that's how you've been leading your life. So once you started talking about being shy but having to move a lot, I'm like, oh my God, she was peripatetic and I didn't even know it.
Absolutely. And I do think it translates to both my career choices, but then also just geographically. Like, I am someone who, after a few years, I do feel the need to move and do something and shake it up. Still very much, which is funny because talking to Ophi, Astro Twins, what my North Node, what I'm supposed to do in this lifetime, is put down roots and actually create a home somewhere. And feels a little daunting, but I think I found it in New York. So I'm excited to see how that transpires. But I always kind of have, like, you know, my passport out just to be able to move around and shake things up. But even in career too, because I've had so many different paths. I don't think actually we've had this conversation, but originally I went to school, to college, to be in the CIA.
Ooh.
I wanted to be a field agent. I really wanted to go into psychology and be a criminal profiler, basically. And a couple of things basically rounded that out. I found out, one, that you have to do a spinal tap in order to be in the CIA.
Oh, ow.
Basically, if you've ever had acid, it can retain in your spinal column. And so, you know, they need to know if you're going to maybe trip out in the middle of an interrogation or something like that. And I was like, oh. And then I met this really great mentor who just asked me point blank when I was 17. He's like, do you want a family someday? And I was like, I do. He's like, then don't go in the CIA. Great. Dreams dashed. Thanks. Wow. And that's when I switched to PR, which brought me into events, which then brought me to where I am today.
Well, by the way, I did not know that about the spinal tap. And that is, I was all ready to see you as Scully, you know, like,
yes. I wanted to get my femme fatale and Nikita on, you know?
Yeah. I mean, Alias, like that whole, but spinal tap, that's a little, ouch.
Did it for me.
Yeah, ouch. So one of your most significant irons in the fire right now is the cannabis sector. And you're the founder of this company, Collective High, and you have a new service offering as a weed doula. And so I want to just, there's so much to talk about there, but I want to start with, like, what does your company do, and what, how did you go on that journey to start a company around this, around cannabis, which I know, you know, has been hot and cold, and I don't know where it is right now in New York. And I know there's also lots of issues around how the industry is growing. So I'm just really curious your perspective on the industry, why you started a company in that industry, and what your company does.
Absolutely. It was never actually my thought to start a cannabis company. That was never something I thought was even going to be an industry I was working in, to be quite honest. I had done PR for myself and my own company in LA when I was living there. And then I wanted job stability because freelancing was just really nitty gritty. And I wanted just the normalcy of collecting a paycheck every 2 weeks and putting my heart and soul into that. And so I moved up to San Francisco for a job. It was going to be event director of a nightclub. And they ghosted on me after I got there.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. They ghosted on me the same week my mom was diagnosed with stage 4 non-Hodgkin lymphoma. And the only reason we found that out is because she broke her femur. Mm. And so she had to have surgery. She was admitted to the hospital. It was so tumultuous. It was like everything that could go wrong did go wrong. Job disappeared. My mom's sick. It's just us two in San Francisco. So I took care of her during this whole period while I was out there. The guy that I had a crush on was dating a married woman. It was just like thing after thing after thing after thing. I was like, what is happening here? So I immediately went on the hunt for a job, was interviewing, and I got hired by a woman-owned cannabis delivery company in San Francisco. Ah. It was the first time I'd ever worked in cannabis. I grew up in a marijuana positive household, age appropriate.
Okay.
And so it was never this bad thing that was demonized. It was just, you know, it's this cool thing, but I never really thought more than cool, gets me high, it's fun, whatever. And then when my mom got sick, I saw how much it helped her, not only emotionally, because of going through chemo, but also with her appetite. Mm-hmm. She had dropped down to 106 pounds. It was really, really terrifying. Mm. And so I just saw it help her in all these really incredible ways. And being able to work at a delivery company at that time really just opened my eyes, because I was taught so much in the onboarding process. We had to go meet with a nurse and really learn the ins and outs of cannabis, ratios, terpenes, everything. So the education was phenomenal. And so my thought process is like, if I come from a household that accepts this and I've been given all this education, how many people do I think are out there who are so far away from knowing any of this and it could totally change their lives too, whether it's pain management or pleasure or mood or appetite? And so I worked for that cannabis delivery company for a little over 2 years, and then dealt with, you know, racism, just really, really icky stuff while I was there. And my mom's cancer came back in 2021. Mm. And we found out Sunday night. I'll never forget, because like the Harry and Meghan special was on Oprah.
Oh, yeah.
We found out, and I was like, I cannot deal with this job and also take care of my mom. It's gotten to that point. So I quit without having a backup. And on the inside, I felt like, whew, you know, sweet relief. And then on the outside, I was like, you just quit and you have no job. Like, what are you doing? You know? And so my friend and I, who also works in cannabis events, we're like, you know, I needed something to do. She wanted something extra to do. We're like, you know, the cannabis industry is really hurting, much to your point of what you're saying earlier, in California. What can we do to help these brands that we love just showcase them to really amazing people? And what can we do to get people out of the house? Because it was March 2021 and people were like ready to get out. And so we threw a scavenger hunt that tied all of these historical touch points that had happened in San Francisco to help legalize cannabis. And we worked with a bunch of dispensaries and craft brands, and people were excited and they had fun, and it felt celebratory and educational at the same time. And so we kind of just had this moment where like, maybe we could do more of this, because the events I'd been seeing in cannabis really lacked. Like the first event I ever went to, I saw a woman walk by in like a little marijuana leaf bikini. And I was like, you've got to be kidding.
My.
Like I did not leave the industry I was in to come over here and now deal with this. So I was like, maybe there's got to be a way we can do better things with that. And so that's how Collective High was really birthed, in an effort to bring education and really fun parties and events to the fold, so that anyone, whether you consume cannabis or not, whether you love it or unfamiliar with it, could come to our events and really feel like they learned something really valuable. They had a good time, consumption based or not.
Wow. Cool. Well, so that sounds amazing. And I love this combination of like, can you give people something to do that's for that time that's was running around, was like getting people after so much time being locked mm-hmm. up. When you think about, I'm a language nerd. And so I'm really interested in the name, like your first real awakening to cannabis was around your mom's illness and what it could do. Beyond maybe the getting high in inappropriate ways. So how do you balance that? When you talk about cannabis with folks, like there's now so much more diversity and variety of what people might be turning to it for. Mm-hmm. And for me, that's actually part of what, so we'll have a little session right now. You can weed doula me a little bit.
Yes. I love it.
So when I grew up, like I probably didn't get stoned till I was in college, and I was totally, you know, smoking pot at a friend's apartment, and mm-hmm. I would laugh for about 30 minutes and be super like giggly, and then I would just go to sleep. Like, and that was my impression of marijuana for a really long time.
Mm-hmm.
But several years ago, I don't know how many years ago, I started using more of the cannabis side for, I had like lotions I used for my achy joints, or I had a tincture I used for sleep. And then I started sort of experimenting with getting some THC, not just CBD, mm-hmm. especially for the sleep aspect. And I had a really interesting conversation with a nephew of mine who is a chef, who said, oh, well, you know, you need to watch your strains, because I use sativa to when I need to be up and alert and ready for work. But then when I come home, I'm pretty amped up. I need to use indica strains to like chill me out, which was eye-opening to me that kind of existed. So I had a really old impression of what marijuana was and cannabis was. And then I just, as it started to be obvious that there were so many different elements to it, I think I got kind of overwhelmed by figuring out what I need or want. And I went to, when it was legalized here in California, I went to a dispensary and I went to one that felt more like Stonerville. And then I went to one that felt more like hippie girl. And I was like, oh, I relate to this one more. And I just asked, I mean, I just basically asked for people's recommendations, but I don't really know. They recommend something to me. I tell them what I want. They recommend something to me. I'm like, okay, I'll try it. But I don't really know myself, like, what should I be looking for? And I think it's, and I've gotten my parents to try it. Like I
love that,
you know, but I still don't really feel like I know what I'm doing, but I just try different things. And then I wonder like, what am I missing by not really knowing what to do to figure out what I need? So help me, weed doula. And,
yes,
like, what do I do to learn that?
This is what I love. This, like every Uber drive I'm in, I have these conversations like, well, what kind of weed can we get you on? Not that I'm a pusher, but I just want people to be able to find what they need so they can have the exact experience they want, because you really can titrate and dial in the experience. And I think a lot of people don't know that.
Exactly.
They just think like, oh, I'll get stoned or not.
Right.
But, you know, much to your point, there's different terpenes, which terpenes affect the potency of the marijuana. And terpenes, for anyone know, that's the aromatic scent. So much like when you smell lavender or rose, that's the terpene of that. Plants have terpenes. This is a flower. It's a plant. It has terpenes. And so it can kind of start to clue you in and to what kind of high it's going to be. So sativa, which is usually going to have like a lemony, piney kind of smell, that's going to be really energizing. Sometimes it's too energizing from people. A lot of times when I hear people like, oh, I don't like it, it just made me paranoid, I'm like, you had a sativa that was too strong for you. Much like, you know, if I'm a tequila person, I have whiskey, it doesn't really go well for me. It's kind of like that. We hate comparing cannabis to alcohol, but it's just like an easy no-brainer comparison that most people understand. And so, you know, it really comes down to, I call it the four I's, which is intake, which I find out, you know, are you maybe suffering from PTSD? Is there something that could affect your high? Then there's inquiry, which is why are you coming to this? Is it pain, pleasure, sleep, you know, all these different things, fun, all of the above, different times. And then intention, you know, what is it that you hope to get out of your session or your high? And then integration, how you take that information and move forward. Because the thing that I love about going to a dispensary that's knowledgeable is they can recommend really great products for you. The thing that I hate for people is that it's so individual. So even if I think something's great for me, it might not do what it needs to do for you, because ultimately the way cannabis interacts with the body is based on our endocannabinoid system, which is a fancy way of saying, like, basically almost think of like your central nervous system in that kind of way, where it's this internal system. CBD usually creates homeostasis within that system, which is why most people can really easily handle CBD.
Yeah.
Now, once you start getting into the different cannabinoids, which THC is one of the many, many cannabinoids, there's about 120 of them, you start getting into different feelings. So some of them are, you know, very energizing, or some of them, you know, give you a heady high. Some of them are more calming, or some of them are more cerebral. So that's what you start to get in. So for instance, like CBN, which is another cannabinoid, that's really great for sleep. So when I hear people are having trouble sleeping, I'm like, let's find you the right CBN mixture that's going to be really great for you. And usually CBN with a little bit of THC and a little bit of CBD is the magic entourage effect. It just means when those three things come together, when any of those come together, they do even better with each other. Kind of like how you are with your best friends. Like, you're great on your own, but when you're with your best friends, you're like, oh, we're our best. So that's how I kind of just like to tell people. But, you know, I think it's really important to know that the way it interacts with your body is individual, which is why I usually tell people, keep a cannabis journal. Start writing down what you have.
I should do that.
When you have it. Because for instance, you know, on some days I've had a more stressful day, so I'll need like a little bit more CBD, you know, because I need that calmness to kind of take place. Other days I'm like, I have a lot to get through. Maybe I didn't even sleep that well, so I need something more energizing to help me get through like spreadsheets and stuff like that. And people are always amazed, like, you get high for spreadsheets? I'm like, I do. There's literally a cannabinoid for everything.
Well, that's what my nephew kind of woke me up to. I really hadn't realized there was this kind of energizing and also focus and clarity kind of, that there, so the fact that there's
not just energy for energy's sake, but like you can actually dial in.
The fact that there's a cannabis product for focus and clarity kind of blows my mind, because that's not at all the cannabis I grew. That's not your mother's cannabis, you know?
Quite literally. And that's what's so amazing is like, they didn't even know about the endocannabinoid system until about the 90s anyway. So you're talking about a system that's relatively new, even for doctors. And now they're understanding, like, you know, the way CBD attaches to the receptor versus THC attaches to the receptor is why CBD works for the body, THC works for the mind. And so you start kind of understanding like, oh, okay, this is how my system is going. And then there's little things that it's just very hard to know, which is sometimes if you have ADD or ADHD, sativa and indica are reversed.
Oh.
And they'll give a different, the opposite effect, basically. Okay. So a lot of it, people don't love hearing this, but a lot of it is experimentation.
Yeah.
So when I work with someone, I like to find out, why are you coming to this? You know, what's going on? You know, what are you wanting? What are you needing? And then starting real low and going slow. Like, both of those are really important, especially when it comes to edibles, because we've all heard the horror stories. I've had it myself of like, it's not working, I'm going to take more. Like, oh, now it's working way too much, you know?
Right,
so
right.
We always say start low, go slow, which means start with a very, very small milligram dose, see how that works. And then your next session, maybe try a little bit more, not necessarily on that session. And a session is just anytime you like consume in one sitting per se.
Okay. So along that language topic, I think weed doula is such an interesting combination. Doula is extremely evocative. I think there's a reason that word is now being applied to other life experiences like death doulas, birth doula, obviously. And then the use of the word weed, which is kind of evocative to me of like the 70s or something. It kind of has this throwback feeling. So just as a word nerd, I would love to know the thinking that went into talking about your service as being a weed doula. Walk me through that.
Yes. I love that you asked, because I love language too. Weed is evocative. You know, I feel like they're trying to sanitize the whole experience by only referring to it as cannabis, because cannabis sounds more clinical.
Yeah.
And there's nothing wrong with cannabis. I used to say cannabis interchangeably with weed, marijuana too, in which we'll get into the language of that, because there's a whole history with that.
Yeah.
And some pushback in some areas. But I wanted weed specifically because of that very feeling of weed. I want to make the kind of, oh no, we shouldn't talk about this, very normalized. Like, that is the whole reason why I wanted to start Collective High and offer these educational services, which is to really destigmatize cannabis, weed, marijuana, all of it all together.
Got it.
And then doula, people really get that concept.
Yeah.
And so I wanted something to really showcase that I was sitting and taking time with people to really walk them through and do some hand-holding around this, because there is, as you said earlier, there's so much oversaturation. There's so much misinformation. There's so much information. And it's like, where do you go to get this stuff? You don't want to make a mistake. You know, no one wants to be like, oh, I tried this thing and that was not what I needed.
You know?
So really making people feel comfortable, at ease, and really safe during the whole process, so they can take in the information that they need.
I also feel like it conveys that this is going to be a journey, and that you're with them on that journey.
Yeah.
Not over.
It's like, not like a one done.
Bye-bye. Yeah. Enjoy the high.
Like, I'm here. One of my favorite things when I did work at the delivery service was I was event facing. So, you know, we would go to, was it Stern Grove? Oh my gosh. Is it? Yeah. Stern Grove, where they'd have like the free concerts and everything in the park. We couldn't bring any cannabis there because you can't have cannabis on federal lands. But I would just sit and talk to people. People would come like, oh, I probably have a stupid question. Like, there are no stupid questions when it comes to cannabis. You know, hit me with your best shot. And so much was just like, I'd had weed. It was okay experience. It was a while ago, or, you know, this was what I got. But now I hear that you can use it for pleasure. You know, a lot of women coming, especially like, you know, I'd say 40 to 60 year old, are starting to come to the like table understanding that you can use cannabis for pleasure, as well as mitigate pain, as well as help sleep, as well as replace the glass of wine. It does all of these amazing things when you know which products work for you and how to go about finding them.
Yeah. The next step for me, I've been using it mostly for sleep and a little bit for like achiness for a long time. And I have one of them. I bought a couple bottles of gummies based on your recommendation from a week or two ago. And I've tried the sleep one. And I have a couple of different products that are more supposed to be about that daytime. And for some reason, those are the ones I've kind of like, I have no idea what that's going to be like because I've never used it in that way before. So I've just held off like doing it because I'm like, and I should just pick a day when I have no pressure, no meetings.
Yeah.
And just,
that's the best way to do
just
it.
Just to see what happens.
Yeah.
But,
I tell people pick a weekend or pick a day, pick some time where you'll be undisturbed.
Yeah.
You know, set yourself up for success. If you're like, I want to get creative cause I want to write, you know, then have your writing tools out, you know, or have your laptop on, or if you want to watch a funny movie, you know, like get that set up, you know, whatever it is, but just really set yourself up so that you, have that to your advantage. So that way it's more likely that you'll experience the high in the way that you want to.
All right. The last thing I really want to dig in a little bit with you about is the industry itself, the intersection with racial issues and criminal justice issues. And there's a lot of promise in this industry, but I think there's also a lot of apprehension about what's driving it now, and also fears about, you know, we're celebrating, especially in states like California, where it's just all legal all the time for any reason, basically. And it's not that way in other states. And I've seen people in chat groups all the time who don't realize that going through like TSA, you know, it's, you're not on California ground once you go through security, but also
you're federal at that point.
But also, the inequity kind of, and I know some states and there's some movement to try and rectify the justice that something that people are touting is like, you know, going easily into business for and touting and just free and easy. And there's people sitting in prison for it still. So I would love to know your thoughts and what you see is where are we going with this?
This is the other half of what I'm really passionate about speaking about in this industry. And I feel like is part of why I was brought into this industry as a Black woman in this space, having worked for predominantly white companies. It's been a really hard pill to swallow to see how I believe intentionally messed up some of the laws and landscape have been carved out. California being that one. I'm hoping that New York is getting it together. I have hope, which is
what did California do wrong?
Oh, what didn't they do? Okay. So I refer to some people call it the black market. I don't call it the black market. Typically we refer to it as the legacy market. I think it's more dignified and respectful because these people did carve it out and it is legacy. But much to your point, there are people sitting in prison right now. And it's my personal belief that no state should be even handing out licenses or operating while people are sitting in prison for the crime that now predominantly white men are like profiting off of.
Yeah.
And I know people point to Biden having signed, you know, legislature to release people, but he did it at a federal level. So there's only about 4,000, a little over 4,000 people that will be released on that. Most of the people locked up in prison for cannabis crimes, whether they're violent or nonviolent, are from the state level. So what we want is action around calling your representatives and getting people early released, records expunged, and apprenticeship, because that's the other missing piece that I think a lot of people leave off the conversation. It's like, okay, you get someone out of jail, you release their records. Who is going to hire them? You know, so that's the third part. But California, they created so many loopholes. I remember being on a phone call with a woman one time. I presume she assumed I was white. And she was sitting there telling me her origin story for how she started her company. And she at one point said, you know, I had to get someone from Oakland so I could qualify. Gut punch and vomit, right?
Oh my God.
And that's so pervasive. Like that attitude is so pervasive, which is like, if we're told no, we're going to work around it so that we can get what we want while still harming the very communities that have continuously been ripped apart. Because it's not just the person who goes to prison, it's their family and it echoes on and on and on. And so it's been really frustrating to see people bend these rules and get around loopholes and, you know, then you have California kind of crashing into itself with distribution having ripped off a lot of people or lots of brands. And so brands are shuttering right and left too. Really amazing quality brands, especially woman-owned brands, especially Black-owned brands, Black Indigenous-owned brands, because they just can't compete with like huge investment money that can spend $300,000 on marketing alone, you know? So it's just, again, inequality permeates out, you know, the ethos of something actually does carry weight and how it rolls out. And so I think the intention was never to actually make it equitable in California. I think the intention was just to roll it out really quickly. You know, you had a lot of people working on the lines to try to make it equitable, but unfortunately, like we see in so many other cases, the people who really need to contribute to this conversation are often shut out. The Black and brown people who carved out this whole network, most of them sitting in prison, were not invited to the table to talk about how we could actually change this, how we could repair the harms from war on drugs and so forth. And so it's really discouraging to see, especially that actually was the final straw with the place I was at. They were put in a Forbes article, and the title of the Forbes article I'll never forget was Delivery Companies Thrive Amid Pandemic by Co-opting the Illicit Markets Blueprint.
Whew. Well, they just said the quiet part out loud.
Right. I had to write to my executive team because they were thrilled about being in this article. And I was like, I need us to be very clear on this messaging because the title literally says co-opting, which I would think would be a red flag. And I hate that I, as the Black person, have to flag this. Like, I can't be the only gatekeeper here.
Yeah.
But I need you to say why you're proud of this and what kind of language you want to use around this. So they ended up scrapping it. But then the retribution was like immediate after that, and made me, that was in December. It's like Christmas Eve. And I was out of there by mid-March.
Oh, wow.
So you still see it. And like I said, I go to the meetings in New York and I sit in on the virtual OCM, which is the Office of Cannabis Management. They're transparent in their meetings, which is really amazing. And so I think that's what it takes, is a lot of the people on various stages of the industry really coming together and insisting that things be done right and that they be done equitably and that they integrate it in a way that really makes sense. And I see New York doing that more so than I saw California doing, which has all these rules, like you can't sell hemp and cannabis in the same space, whereas in New York you can. Huh. So it's just a lot of really interesting laws and hooks.
I think you said something really interesting, which is that California didn't make policy with the intention of being equitable. And I think that's something that people don't realize is true. You know, thinking about equity across industries, it is not enough. You don't have to policy make or legislate inequity. Inequity is what will happen naturally if you don't have
a byproduct.
If you don't have the intention of policy making or legislating equitably. So
absolutely,
people want to say, well, it's unintended consequences. But I think we have to get to the point where we can acknowledge that if you didn't plan for equity, it is a known consequence. You cannot call it absolutely unintended.
It reminds me, I was having this conversation the other day because I was talking with one of another Alliance member. And she was saying how great it was that there was all these DEI rules carved out, you know, from 2020 and beyond. I was like, yes. Can you tell me the stats of how many of those people are still at the company? Because a lot of them were disappeared in the late of the night in 2021, 2022, and even this year. And so it reminds me of Dartmouth, and that if you are an Indigenous member, you can go to Dartmouth for free. They have open tuition. As I guess an apology for theft and genocide. But my point is, how many are graduating? Because that's really the key. And I think a lot of white people in this space and other spaces really miss that, which is you can open the doors, but unless you create the environment that actually makes us feel seen, welcomed, heard, listened to, and appreciated, respected, and so forth, it's just platitudes and performative actions.
Exactly. Oh, this is something, this is one of my, actually, it's one of my, as a speaker, this is one of my talks, which is about operationalizing inclusivity, because a lot of companies, they do have hiring rubrics that are supposed to address it, and maybe even into performance reviews, but a lot of them are not achieving the advancement goals that they set. And the reason is they have churn. They have people are not staying around. And I think a lot of people think, oh, if I just change the people, that will change the culture. And that is not actually where the culture, sure, culture is made up of people, but you know what else culture is made up of? Policy and process. So if you bring people into your policy and process, which has not been inclusive, you're going to do one of two things. You're going to change them. They're going to change to fit into the process or policy, or they're going to bounce out because it's not for them. So if you don't think about how you're running your business every day, how you're innovating every day, you're going to change your hiring statistics. But to your point, you're not, how many are graduating? How many are advancing? How many get promoted? How many reach leadership? And those numbers are completely static in so many industries. Because they don't, and then it can just,
the intention isn't there though. The intention is actually change.
Yes.
It's to look good. It's to not be called racist.
Well,
it's not sit
and
with
it's
the discomfort.
Also to create a self-validating, see, it's them. We hired more women. We hired more people of color. We hired more this, but they can't advance. And it becomes this kind of reinforcement of bias when they have every opportunity to instead use it as a way to blow up their bias.
I brought it up in my quit letter, actually, to the delivery company.
How'd that go?
It was very specific. Well, not great.
Kill Supreme.
Right. There's this amazing, I'll send you a link too, because it's a really great article. It's an article within another article. The article I linked in my quit letter was in defense of Meghan Markle and the angry black woman. It's a Medium article and it's brilliant. And in that article, she quotes this other UGA professor, which is where I went, who coined the term, it's a phenomenon that happens. I've experienced it so many times, but when you go from office pet to office threat.
Ooh.
And it's exactly this.
Wow.
Because it's like you're babified. Like you're actually, it's really insulting when you first get in there because you're like, oh my God, you're just so sweet. You're so cute. Oh my God. You know, and it's just like, oh, you're the best. And you're just, oh my gosh. And then the second you start becoming threatening, which is usually when you want to rise, when you want to be promoted, when you want a raise, suddenly become very threatening. And then it's, you know, I've lost a job because of white women's tears before, you know? And so it's just like, it happens and it's so insidious. And much to our points, like if you don't actually intend to change and create a culture of change, you churn out talent and they're in and then they're out.
The Other Black Girl, it's a novel.
I know what you're talking about.
Okay.
I haven't read it yet though. I'm like,
I don't know. I don't know if I recommend you do because I feel
I know. That's why I haven't. Because I'm like, do I?
It's
is
painful.
It gonna be so triggering. It's truthful, you know, because it's like it churns you up. Like in the same way of reading Native Son during 2020, I had to put it down.
Yeah,
it's a by James Baldwin.
It's a painful read.
And
so I don't know if I can recommend. Like it's really good.
I get it. That's the really, duality that I keep vascillating between.
Yes, it went places I didn't expect. It was like, it's genre busting a little bit. Like it's a really good book, but it is a really like, you spend the whole time going, you know, it's hard.
I think that's the thing. Cause it's like, that's literally what happened with Native Son. I decided to start a revolutionary book club in 2020 with some friends. First book was Brave New World. Then we had on Tyranny by Dan Snyder and Native Son, and they came like all these really heavy books. And I was like, where do I put this rage? Because I know I'm aware, I'm educated enough, it's my experience, but now where do I channel this so that I don't actually get sick? And in a world that's still not making space for that, you know, just putting up little black boxes and saying, go us, it becomes hard to take in that information and sit with it and then know what to do with it.
I used to be in a social impact book club that was much the same. We would read all heavy nonfiction. And a lot of times it felt like going to a TED, like I haven't been to the big TED, but I've been to like TED Women and a bunch of TEDx's. And it felt like that to me because I was just being inundated with problems that I didn't really see. How can I be part of the solution? And is there a solution? Right. Or is this just intractable? Right. And in 2020, when the pandemic hit, I thought, oh, I'll get so much reading done. And I couldn't focus and I couldn't even watch anything that was stressful. Like I tried to watch Little Fires Everywhere which was this Reese Witherspoon and Kerry Washington. Mm-hmm. I read the book and liked it. So I'm like, oh, I'll like this. But by the end of the first episode, I was so like stressed out.
Tense.
I'm like, Ted Lasso, give me Ted Lasso and Schitt's Creek. And like, and I couldn't read it all. And so I did solve that for 2021. I like set a little goal, 20 minutes a day. And I gave myself permission that not everything I read had to be the great American novel or the most important nonfiction. I could read genre fiction. I could read memoir. I could read like, I freed myself to not be so serious. And so I read a lot now. In fact, I read more than anything. I just read more and more. But yeah, I just read a book that's somewhat to our conversation about people in prison. I read the book called A Knock at Midnight, which is by Brittany K. Barnett. And, you know, to me, it joins The New Jim Crow and Just Mercy as kind of a trilogy of criminal justice reform, why it's needed, and the problems with mass incarceration. And I think that most of the cases in A Knock at Midnight are more related to crack and cocaine than they are to marijuana. I could be wrong, but I'm remembering that.
No, you're right.
Mostly what it is. But the point about the disparity in sentencing and the new Jim Crow, of course, is all about starts it way back at the disparity in policing and where they, where they go,
where they locate. And because it's like what we were saying before, like if you are doing all these traffic stops,
yes,
and you're bumping it up. Like if you go sit in black neighborhoods, then yes, you will find lots of crime because that's all you're doing. But if you were to disperse it and be in white neighborhoods, Asian neighborhoods, black neighborhoods, it would look a lot different. It would look more even.
And I think that's why I think her work is the most important piece, because I've read and watched documentaries where they kind of start with the justice system. They start with the order part of like, how did you get into the criminal justice system? And then it's super, super unfair. And I just know that there's an undercurrent that some people are going to have about, well, just don't do anything wrong. Just don't end up in the justice system.
Right.
I'm not worried. And I'm like, no, it all starts back to where
there's a thread and you keep pulling it.
You just keep pulling it and it all starts back to where do they go looking for?
Well, and also very specifically back to like the crabs in a barrel, without even referencing how was it CIA, COINTELPRO, et cetera, injected crack into black neighborhoods in the 80s. Like it was an actual whole movement. And, you know, especially coming from San Jose, you have the Mercury with Weber. Weber? Gary Weber, who was the one who worked for San Jose Mercury, busted the story, this huge story that the CIA is hand feeding through like ops to put crack cocaine in black neighborhoods. Like it was a whole operation. And then he commits suicide, which he didn't. And so you have to have this understanding of the history of it. Like there was no laws on cannabis until 1935. You have to understand the history of racism with Hearst, you know, using his newspapers to tackle immigration. And that's where the word marijuana really got used a lot to try to associate with Mexicans coming in. Yeah. You know, they're sending us their worst. That kind of rhetoric was happening back then. Yeah. And you have Anslinger, who's the what's now the DEA, but he's the father of the carceral state, working to put Billie Holiday and black musicians and jazz musicians in prison. And you have to understand all that. And then when decriminalizing started happening, it's because white college students were starting to smoke weed and they're like, okay, well, we can't arrest them. And, you know, it just goes through all these really historical points. And then the fact that people make so much money off of private prison, you know, I think we talked about it before. Slavery by Another Name is another one that I'd add to that list. Yep. And then 13th by Ava DuVernay. Because it really just shows you how this was a business. And once you lost cotton money, you need to turn to something else. And prison's just as good as any. And now we have that today.
Yes. I mean, So all to say that while this industry is changing, you know, that it is really important that, as you said, that people are at the table and people are at the bank. Getting coin and being part of this legalized, very potentially lucrative industry. Mm-hmm. And if that doesn't happen, which I know it's not in many places, you know, it's...
Well, COVID changed a lot of that, right? Like I never thought I'd see Mississippi say, okay, we're gonna But COVID ravaged so many state budgets that they had to look for other sources to bring in a lot of cash very quickly, and cannabis can do that. And so it's been interesting seeing which states have at least taken like a medical approach, because that's usually the first part.
That is usually first.
Recreational. Yeah. So I have hope. I have hope that especially as more and more states turn over, it's going to be harder to keep people in prison for it. But it mm-hmm. will take us as a community of concerned citizens to harass our representatives yeah. and say, why are people in prison for this right now? I can go down the street and buy it. I can have it delivered to me. Why is yeah. someone sitting in prison for this now?
Yeah, totally agree. You know, I'll put in the show notes, everyone, some links to how to, I'm yeah. sure there's a resource where you can look up what are the laws in your state. Because I think, June, a point you made that's so important is that we focus so much on what the federal government does. But in my own book, Roadmap for Revolutionaries, we talked so much more about what happens in the state and the local level Absolutely. Than at the federal level. And when it comes to these prison sentences and crimes, these are predominantly state-based. And so mm-hmm. what are the laws in your state? Like, I feel like we as citizens, we now have to keep track of what are the laws in my state about abortion? What are the laws in my mm-hmm. state about expunging drug records and drug
we
laws?
We have to be knowledgeable.
What are the laws? Yeah. I mean, gun safety, like this is where we can have, we are so much closer to where the action is working at yeah. the state level. And you know, Congress and the federal level may continue for a while to be very, very much gridlocked and, you know, we're working so hard to get incremental changes made. But at the state level, things can sometimes move pretty quickly. And then that drives things. That's what happened with marriage equality. I mean, Absolutely. This is what happens in a lot of things. We drive it at the state level. And, you know, I would just say, speaking for California, New York, between us, we are a massive number of the population. There's a reason. Yeah. There's a reason that when California and New York do things, a lot of states often follow, is because, you know, California has almost 40 million residents. New York has more than 20 million. I'm not sure if they're at mm-hmm. 25. Like that is a big, big chunk of
Absolutely.
Populace. And it becomes ever more unfair to say, oh, like 25% of the population has no criminal liability for using, you know, how can mm-hmm. we, how can it be fair when 25 and then 30 and then 35% of the population can do X, Y, or Z? We do not have equal protections under the law.
Absolutely not. Absolutely not. And also with an election coming up, this is when you have the yeah. most power to initiate and enact change. So I want everyone, at least with that takeaway, I hate leaving it on like, you know, a disparaging note, but I think there's so much hope in the fact of we the people, that's yep. all that's ever shifted things. Yep. And so if we can mobilize, unionize, you know, harass, you know, your representatives, but with an upcoming election, we can do a lot of change for a lot of good.
Yeah.
In all the directions that we need to right now.
And there are a lot.
So many.
Now's the time. Now's the time. June, thank Absolutely. You so much for,
oh my gosh, thank you.
First of all, sharing the information. I feel personally edified that I know more and for also taking it in all the different directions. It's sitting on top of a complex stew of things that have gone on in this country for a long time. But like you said, I think there's tremendous, no matter how much it feels like sometimes we're always taking a step back, there is forward momentum. There is progress. It is happening. Maybe it's not as fast as we want, and especially not in all the areas, but we keep pushing and things keep changing and that we just need to do more of it. And so where can people find you? Where can people secure your services to get their personal, I feel like I got a little mini personal session. Like where can they?
Oh my gosh. Yes. And if you want a longer session, let's go for it. I'm always open to email. My email is June, like the month, at collective-high.com. Also on Instagram is collective-high. Please feel free to reach out to me. Our website is also collective-high.com. I love answering questions. I can send you an intake form if anyone's interested in weed doula services. But you know how I can help people is
I'll
either
put it in the show notes. Yeah, please send me that form.
Perfect. Perfect. I definitely will. So awesome. Yeah, I just want to help people feel educated and empowered around cannabis. So
terrific. Thank you, June.
Absolutely. Thank you so much.
Well, now we come to the portion of the show I call quick takes, and I'm going to give you a content warning that this is maybe a more somber quick takes than I typically have. There's a couple things I'll discuss that are tough. And the first of those is that just today, as I'm recording this, we found out that one of the original mommy blogger, Heather Armstrong, died yesterday. That would be May 9th, based on when I'm recording. And I'm just going to read you, I posted something friends only on Facebook, and I'm just going to read it because it really shared what I wanted to say. And you can, of course, look up the details, and there's lots and lots of mainstream media press. But what I wanted to say is that, so people like to think celebrities sell conference tickets. This is something I argue with conference organizers about all the time. It was never my experience with Blog Her that celebrities really moved observably a ton of tickets right after they were announced. Though there are two exceptions. The first being when we announced President Obama was going to give opening remarks for Blog Her 12 via live video. We saw a big ticket rush. But when it comes to celebrities, whether it's Kerry Washington or Martha Stewart or Gwyneth Paltrow, or even Serena Williams or Kim Kardashian for that matter, we didn't see like immediately a bunch of people just go, boom, make the decision, except for one time. And that was the very first Blog Her in 2005, when we announced that Heather Armstrong, known as Deuce in the blogging world, was going to speak. It brought just a flood of registrations right away. I mean, the scale was different between 2005 and 2012, but the impact on the event was really probably proportionally the same. We sold out that first event with 300 attendees, and we had a long wait list, and I'm sure that Heather was certainly the biggest reason why. And it wasn't because she was a celebrity, although in our world she really was, but because people hungered to hear from her and see her and be in an interactive environment with her because she had a unique voice and she touched people. She was boundary breaking and industry making. But for a long time, she was also in a lot of pain, which she lived publicly just like everything else. And sometimes being in that kind of pain causes someone to cause pain themselves to others. And this was all, you know, visible, although I'm sure we know just an inch out of a mile of her story. I did not remain in contact with Heather after those first few years of Blog Her. I cannot claim to really know her or even to have followed her closely in many years. And in fact, I unfollowed her last year. But it feels appropriate to acknowledge her, to give her that due, and to feel so very sorry for that loss that both her family, including her two children, and our entire community is feeling. For me, the quote-unquote Blog Her era, you know, it ended naturally years ago. At this point, 6 years ago, when I left the company that acquired us. But all I kept hearing in my head today, after hearing the news about Heather, was end of an era, end of an era. It kept popping in my head. But that's 20 years of having an impact and 20 years of being one of the first and true influencers. So for Heather, all I can hope is that now she feels free. That's the best I can hope, is that now she is free. The second heavy thing I wanted to talk about is I just wanted to share, I'll share it in the show notes. Jordan Neely was murdered on the New York City subway last week, more than a week ago now, because he was being disruptive and yelling and made people uncomfortable. And so I recorded a short video that talked about just one of the many, many times that I felt uncomfortable on the New York City subway. And in fact, I'll go more than say I was uncomfortable. This particular story I tell is a time I was afraid. And But just like Jordan Neely, the person I was afraid of in this story did not hurt anyone, did not touch anyone. They were just upset and yelling and also clearly experiencing poverty and also clearly experiencing mental health issues. And you know what? You can go listen to the story, but the point I wanted to make about the story is that even going through that, and that wasn't the only time I felt that way on the subway, it just never occurred to me that someone in the car should step up and kill the person because I was afraid or because any of us were afraid. Like, so it's a very upsetting story, and it's upsetting because of the way people can try to twist it to make it seem like this is rational. But all I can say is if you all want to say that people who make other people uncomfortable on the subway, anything is possible, all options are open, you're going to have chaos. You're going to have chaos because that subway is great. It gets you everywhere and incredibly economically and affordably. But there's a lot that goes on down there. And a lot of it probably makes some people super uncomfortable. So I don't know. You can watch my TikTok for more, but I will put the link in the show notes. And now to kind of start to not end on such a, well, I don't know, maybe it'll still be, there's still more. I will share a link to my Substack newsletter where I talk about rejecting conventional advice for women to stop apologizing. This is one of those things like the conventional wisdom to trust your gut, to not have imposter syndrome, to never apologize, et cetera, et cetera. There's a bunch of things that are supposed to, you know, make women seem more strong and powerful for the workplace. But I think a lot of this advice is just trying to turn us into the dicks we wish men wouldn't be. So put a link to that. That is just the teaser. I also want to share my forever co-founder, Jory Desjardins, wrote an amazing post about what she's working on now and the concept of fractional leadership versus consulting. Now, I do both, but there is a difference, and I really am trying to lean into the fractional opportunities versus pursuing as much of the consulting and coaching. And she explains it so well that really, you know, you ought to read it. But, you know, her point is that for early stage startups, blowing their budget on a senior person with a lot of expertise and a lot of capability, they would be so much better served by hiring them fractionally. And I do sometimes feel like I could get the stuff I need to get done in halftime. And part of it is about managing around managing and managing around communications and focus. And early stage startups should be about nothing but focus. So I think her post is just amazing. So I wanted to link to it. Back on the sad road, Allison Holker finally had a lengthy interview. She is the widow of Twitch, Stephen Boss, and she speaks with Hoda on the Today Show. And it's really sad. It just made me sad all over again, but she's very, at the same time, there's something beautiful about how she shares about what they had. And given Heather's death and Twitch's death and the work that now Allison is doing around mental health awareness, you know, it continues obviously to be this really important topic. So I'm going to link to that because I think it's, if you cared about Twitch, which I did, and Allison, which I totally did, then you're going to want to watch it. And finally, I will just end with two pop culture things I consumed. I read a book called The Marriage Portrait by Maggie O'Farrell, and it is set back in the kind of, I think, not medieval, more like Renaissance times. It's sort of historical fiction, which I actually really like historical fiction. And it's about a very, very young girl who's married off to this duke. And he seems to be like Jekyll and Hyde a little bit. In fact, I just watched the first episode of Queen Charlotte, and it kind of reminded me of that because on the one hand, King George in the first episode was charming and awesome and made her feel like, hey, maybe everything's going to be all right. And then by the end of the episode, he's kind of turned and showed this other side. And that's what the whole ride is in The Marriage Portrait. It's really good. And if you like historical fiction, you will enjoy it. And lastly, an album that, you know, it somehow missed me. And then I forget where I saw someone reference it. Willie Nelson, who is in his 90s, he released an album called A Beautiful Time. And if you've appreciated his music and his presence over the years, I think this is an album you'll really enjoy. And he has a lot of duets and partnerships on it. And it's, there's something really beautiful about him and still producing music and still having something to say. It really reminds me of when Johnny Cash recorded an album very, very late in his life. And it's the same kind of feel to it, which has a necessary melancholy, because he is in his 90s, but is also just, you know, when someone's got it, they've got it. And Willie Nelson has got it. And so maybe I will leave you on that note. Check all of that out, and hopefully you will enjoy some of it.
That's it for this episode of The Op-Ed Page. Thank you so much for listening. As always, I'll share links to everything I discussed in the show notes. And if you want to talk to me, you can find me in multiple places. I'm Adelisa C on Twitter, for as long as that's going to last. Adelisa CP on Instagram and TikTok. And I'm trying out Mastodon and Spoutable and all those things. And my newsletter, This Weekish, serves as a kind of blog where subscribers can comment. So you can find that and subscribe at alisacp.substack.com. Again, one last plea to share and subscribe, rate and review if you like what you hear. I super appreciate it. Have a great week. Stay healthy.